Mr. Love had to be even.
You may have not been captured very well, Valerie, because of your line. So once your line is clear, we will come back to you. Honorable members, we continue where we left yesterday. On the bill, ERT bill, B1 2020. I'm told that B1 2020 means this was the first bill to be tabled by this portfolio committee in 2020 in Parliament. Advocate, are you ready?
Yes, good morning, Chair. I'm just waiting for the screen sharing to be enabled here from my side again. but I think just to remind members, we'll be taking, continuing from yesterday on page 13 of the bill, part B, clause 13, which is also one of the clauses that created quite a bit of interest in the submissions regarding the access to information that is requested through this. This will also link up with the discussion points that were raised yesterday for the PIA and Poppy Acts. So our legal advisors will just have to be on hand here for members. There, my screen sharing is back. So Chairperson, the document should be on screen now. I'm just going to enlarge. So this is the clause where we are at, Chairperson. If you can see, just let me know.
Well, if you enlarge a bit, for those of us who have just, thank you very much. Everybody.
Okay, Chair, I see your mic is muted there.
If I can see, everybody can see, I think we are ready to go.
Okay, Chair. clause 13 is regarding information that the regulator can request from statistical information, forecasts of demand for facilities that the transport providers will be using, development plans for facilities, material changes to control of persons licensed. They can request information reasonably required for them to take their decisions regarding pricing and tariffs, and they are required to maintain confidentiality of the information provided. Chairperson, just on this, there were quite a few comments from different sectors regarding access to the information. I know from dealings with Gautrain in the past, some of the contract agreements, the PPPs with the concessionaires, and I think even with Sunrail, that might also be the case. There are some trade information in some of these contracts and specifications that are not always allowed to be released. So they did indicate some concerns there. Again, the members also raised the issues of FIRE and Poppy that came up yesterday. So this is a clause that we really need to make sure that it is in line with the other legislation that is currently applicable to access and sharing of information and retaining that information's confidential nature, so that this piece of legislation does not exceed its bounds, and that it does not in the end also cause trade infringements, trade information infringements and the likes thereof. There were some questions that if the information does get to the regulator, what information can the public then also in terms of FIRE possibly request from the regulator? And some of these trading bodies, transport providers, just had some concerns regarding that. I don't know. Okay, we can go. Clause 14 then deals with disclosure requirements, which is also linked to the above one. They can also look at some financials and relevant information. And then 15 deals with complaints against regulated entities. There were some comments in the submissions regarding where these complaints will come from. Is it complaints that's going to be coming from the public or other competitors in the market? And then how the regulator will be dealing with those. Also linked with some of the concerns raised on complaints that do get sent to the Competition Commission and how those complaints versus the complaints to the regulator will be dealt with, Chair. I think I'm going to just pause here before we get to part C so that we can deal with these concerns on the information aspects and complaints being lodged to the regulator and how those issues will be dealt with and investigated, because there were also some issues on the powers of investigation raised in submissions in terms of how far it will stretch. Will it go into the same bounds as the Criminal Procedure Act allows investigations, or exactly how far the regulator can stretch when they do look at investigating complaints? Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Advocate. Thank you very much. Let's get responses, comments. Honorable Mangu.
Good morning once more, Chair. Thank you, Advocate. I had already made my input yesterday, and I am sure that it was properly captured at the beginning. However, the slight addition that I would like to make here is that it would be I think it would be prudent that whether it will be covered under the FIRE Act, which I think it is, I'm thinking aloud, that information that the regulator, or decisions rather, that the regulator would have taken on one thing or the other, that should be able to also be an opportunity for those who would like to get it to understand how did they get to this regulator. And I'm testing my understanding to say the FIRE Act should be able to cover that, should anybody require such information from the regulator now, not the regulator from the entities. The one of entities or regulator getting information I spoke to yesterday. I'm sorry, there's a chopper coming to pick me up. I don't know why they came very early. So sorry for that noise. So I'm saying, would the FIRE Act, maybe let me ask the question just for clarity from the legal experts, would the FIRE Act cover people who might want to get information from the regulator as it relates to a decision that would have been taken? If that is the case, then I would be covered, Chair. Thank you. That's all. I have made my contribution yesterday.
Thank you very much. Honorable Manu, can you be in a habit of lowering your hand?
That habit is going to happen today, I promise you.
Thank you very much. Any other taker before we move to the department and our advisors here? I think we should take this opportunity, raise issues, our concerns about this bill, and as we amend, because in our next sessions, we should be able to engage fruitfully, even on questions we have asked the department to clarify. I'm sure that will happen on the 10th, that is next Wednesday. So members should not hesitate to ask any question for clarity or any added information that members should deem it fit to have in order for us to process this thing properly. Let me get Honorable McDonald. I can see your hand is up.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, colleagues. Also, thank you to Advocate Nell and all the officials from the Department of Transport that's here. Chairperson, regarding the part in 13 where 2 read together with subsection 60, it's says that they can receive any confidential information and that they would keep the confidentiality in some of these instances. Chairperson, I need some clarity from the legal advisors, because as raised by Advocate Nell and raised by many others in their comments, when you're going to send in some information that makes your company different from another company so that you can make more money for an example, and I'm just thinking aloud, like Honorable Manchu said, how will that information be protected? Because the minute you give that information to the regulator, the regulator is then bound by the PIE Act to disclose that information should somebody require that information. So I'm just I just need some clarity there, Chair, so that when this thing is, when we are done with this thing, there's no somebody that's going to complain to the regulator and then they're going to get some proprietary information about another company so that they can undermine that company in its business, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable McDonald. Be also in the habit of lowering your hand. Thank you very much. Let's get the department, and after the department, we'll get our advisors. Mr. Ntenza or Mr. Sekudo, you want to say something? We allow you to say something.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. Thank you very much for the opportunity again today. I'll request that Mr. Sekudo tackles this one right away. We apologize up front for our instability. For some reason, which I don't understand, today we are more unstable than we were yesterday in terms of network. He has indicated that his network is poor and is unable to, he's struggling and gets cut out many times. I do not think we'll be able to provide the answer directly to this question on PAIA and how the information could be protected as it, while it is also deemed to be public information. Would, if we are allowed, would defer until I have consulted with Mr. Sikudo. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, let me get our advisors. I think they are here, parliamentary advisor and state law advisor.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning, Ms. Gangan.
Okay, I'm battling with a very unstable connection as well. So I've missed the first member's comments. I will liaise with the state law advisor and I can catch up on what I've missed out. But my connection is unstable, so please ask for your indulgence. With regards to confidentiality and clause 13 and 60. Clause 60 says that, and I'm literally going to just read clause 60 if that's okay, just so that we can get an idea, the members can get an idea of how it makes provision for confidentiality. At the outset, however, I think that we would need to consider just expanding maybe by means of an addition where we say that the constitutional acts, PAIA and POPI, I mean, their life was given to them by the Constitution. And those acts are quite comprehensive and deal with aspects of confidentiality. So in this bill, I would propose that we would have a clause just alluding to the fact that we would be guided, or POPI and PAIA would be taken into account in dealing with this particular act. With regards to clause 60, it says claims that information is confidential. When submitting information to the regulator or to an inspector or an investigator appointed in terms of this act, a person may claim that all or part of the information is confidential. Any claim contemplated in subsection 1 must be supported by a written statement explaining why the information is confidential. The regulator must consider a claim made in terms of subsection 1 and immediately make a decision on the confidentiality of the information and access to that information, which decision may or may not be supported by reasons. I'm going to just skip to 65, if any reasons for a decision in terms of this act would reveal any confidential information, the regulator or a court must provide a copy of the proposed reasons to the party claiming confidentiality at least 5 business days before publishing those reasons. Within 5 business days after receiving a copy of the proposed reasons in terms of subsection 5, a party may apply to the court for an appropriate order to protect the confidentiality of the relevant information. So clause 60 provides for the regulator to engage with the party claiming that the information is confidential. It allows a conversation between the two parties, and then ultimately, once those reasons have been provided, if the party claiming that it is confidential information has recourse to the courts if they're experiencing difficulty in that regard. So I'm of the view that 60 is quite comprehensive. And it does make provision for engagement between the parties regarding confidential information. But over and above that, this act will take into account and be guided by POPI and PAIA. And we must certainly look at adding something to that just to bolster this bill in that regard. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can we get the state law advisor? Ms. Harichiren.
Sorry, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and all present in the meeting. With regards to the issue of confidentiality, we echo the sentiments of the Parliamentary Law Advisor. We note that comments have been raised regarding the issue of privacy and confidentiality of information in the submissions made regarding the bill. And as a possible suggestion, we suggest that the department consider maybe possibly amending the wording of Clause 60 to provide for the provisions of PIA and POPI. And it's our humble suggestion that they also consider Section 63 of the PIA Act, which provides for the mandatory protection of privacy of third party, of a third party who is a natural person. And yes. We believe that this issue should be, we should receive some clarity from the department on this issue. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Advocate?
Chair, if the PLA can possibly just cover Mr. Manku's concern about access of the public or anybody else to the regulator's decisions. In my view, I do think PIA will cover access to that, but they can just expand on that. I'm not sure if the bill explicitly makes provision for that access. I do know here in Section 14.1, they do say that the regulator must define and publish some of their standards and information. So it could be in the bill, but we can just get input about the member's question on access to the regulator's decisions.
Babunden.
Yeah, if I may, it's Mwekiti Sikuru. I'm back online.
Thank you very much.
The dance is struggling as well. Can I come in, Chair?
Yes, you are already in. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning, Honorable members. Good morning, colleagues and members who are part of the meeting. Yes, I may put a disclaimer up front that I'm struggling with network care. I even connected with the phone. See if both could work, but both have a problem. But hopefully I will not have a problem beyond my remarks now. And I may have missed a lot in terms of this discussion, but suffice to say that the department's view is that the issue of confidentiality of information has been indeed a big issue in our discussions and a big issue in the two public consultations that we have had. And hence you would then see section 13 subsection.
Chairperson, that's not assisting, Chair. We can't hear a word.
Ms. Ntenza? Well, maybe we should then... allow this question to stand over until we can get hold of Mr. Sikudo or deal with it on the 10th. If we all agree, Honorable Manu.
Chair, Thank you very much. And thank you for the response from the legal colleagues. However, just wanted to say on the last comment by our state law advisor, Red, that it's now no longer the department, it's us. She was saying the department should consider. And I want to say, no, it is our process, the commitment for them to look at a clause that will explicitly mention PAIA and POPI Act is welcome. I think once we see that, we will also see if my question has been responded to. But I think, as Advocate Nell said, I think I might as well be covered, but plead with them as they draft that clause dealing with PAIA and POPI Act that they consider my question, and then I'm sure we should be covered, Chair, going forward. Thank you so much, Chair.
Let's make it.
You are muted, Chair. You have to start from the beginning. You are completely muted.
Let's make it our decision as a committee. And with that, let me see any hand that supports.
Chairperson, Honorable MacDonald, I support the submission.
Seconded. Thank you very much. Support, seconded. Any hand that is against? Nothing. So that becomes the resolution of this committee. Advocate, can we move?
Okay, Chair, we are on part C that deals with complaint investigations by the regulator. Clause 16 deals with the direct referrals to the council. This is the area where we just need to make sure who will all be able to do these referrals, as long as it covers the public as well as players in the industry or other interested parties. There is the aspects of the hearing that can be held. I think, and then there were some concerns about where appeals perhaps to these decisions by the council, if there is allowance for that. I'm just trying to recall the submissions on these sections. Going to clause 17 is the consideration of complaints by the regulator. It's two types of complaint processes, one that goes to the council and one that goes to the regulator. And then the outcome of these investigations. So there's different issues or different types of outcomes that are identified here. The department can possibly just indicate if this list is going to be a closed list, if this is the only types of decisions or outcomes that can be achieved, or if there are others that are possible. Clause 19 on consent orders, where there's hearing of evidence and there's agreements in terms of consent orders, the issuance of compliance notices, an example that the committee's dealt with regarding compliance notices, I can refer to the compliance notices that the railway safety regulator issues, but this will be compliance notices from an economic regulation perspective to make sure that the transport players that are regulated in terms of the bill comply with the decisions made by the regulator. It gives the time frames. Some of the submissions would have said 15 business days might not have been long enough. for consideration there. Directed price control reduction. There was a few comments over a broad spectrum regarding the impact and price controls determinations, what formula the regulator will be using in order to get to these decisions, and if there are changes, for example, whether the percentage, how the department reached the percentage or the decision about the percentage, that it may not exceed more than 10% of the entity's annual turnover. And then by when these kind of decisions will have to be implemented and whether it would have taken all the necessary concerns raised by, for example, the e-hailing companies, your Transnets, Gautrain Management Agency, because they will have their meetings and set their prices. And if there's a need to do a price reduction, that will affect their projections for several years in terms of their budget. So there needs to be a sense of a correlation on if these types of decisions are taken, will it be on an annual basis? Some submissions suggested that there should be a look at doing it on a three-year basis. Just if you link it up with how entities and departments and businesses would normally project their budgets, they would have a three-year or five-year cycle. So if it's an annual price reduction, that is going to be quite difficult for them to make sure that their budgets line up and that their financials line up. So we're going to take it up to this clause because after this we get to the review of decisions. That is it from my side for now.
Thank you, Advocate. Let's get the department. Yes. Mr. Sekundo, are you here? Abuntenza? Okay, we'll come back to the department. State law advisors, do you have anything to say? Let me allow you an opportunity to say something.
Chair, we have no comment at this stage.
Okay, no comment at this stage. That was the state law advisor, Mayor Harry Charan, parliamentary advisor.
Thank you, Chair. I have nothing to add. Regarding these sections.
Okay. So we're waiting for the department to have a say. Let me try and go back and see if we do get anybody from the department.
Attenda is online, Ms. has joined, but Mr. Sekundo is not able to connect due to the unstable connection. But Advocate Masumbu.
Okay, you are going yourself, Valerie. Advocate Masumbuga. Anybody from the department? Okay. Advocate, can we note the issues that the department was supposed to deal with them and see if we can get them at a later stage? Otherwise, they are making our work very difficult, eh?
Chi, I'm just going through their responses to some of these comments on the PowerPoint that they presented or flagged up yesterday. I'm just trying to get the sections. I know on some of the issues that were raised, I don't see detailed responses to the first few of these clauses. They did have a response on section 21.4, as there was a submission that touched on 21.4 regarding this 10% issue. The department's response on their PowerPoint was that the comment is noted. The maximum limit of 10% revenue reduction is not meant to harm any entity leading to bankruptcy, provision inefficient, unreliable services. Instead, it's meant to promote efficient and conducive environment to conduct business, contributing towards economic growth and development. On the response to Transnet's concerns on 21.3, they indicated a direct price control reduction is a form of penalty which can be levied on a firm which has contravened the bill. It will only be levied after due process has been observed for a finite period. In function, it is equivalent to a fine, but with the advantage that the money is distributed to customers and thus restitution is made during the price reduction period. Penalties will apply to NPA and TFR turnover. Chair, that is the only responses I see to some of these concerns that are raised to these sections. I think it would assist if we get members' input. If it has some legal clarity that needs to be provided, then our legal advisors can jump in there, Chair.
Okay. Let's take Honorable McDonald, followed by Honorable Mangu, and followed by Honorable Sithole, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, on 16.3, it says there the council must conduct a hearing of each matter referred to it in terms of the section in accordance with provision of section 23. And then in 23, it says there, the hearings of any matter of by the council must be conducted expeditiously and in accordance with the principles of natural justice and may be conducted as informally as possible. And then the hearings are open to the public. Chairperson, is this to have a hearing on each complaint? Is that not going to make this regulator swamped or burdened by 10,000 complaints a month, and at the end of the day it can't get to all of these hearings? I just need some clarity. Do we need to say that we have to have a hearing on each? Can there not be some sort of sifting process to go through some of these complaints before they have to have a hearing on each of these? Thank you, Chairperson.
Is that a question or a suggestion, Honorable?
It's a question, comma, suggestion, Chairperson.
Okay. Honorable Mann.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I've gone through these, and as the advocate was going through them, I am fairly comfortable with what Part C covers. However, my concern is that there is no mention, unless I missed it, I've gone through the Act, where there are complaints against the regulator. You will notice that even on the previous issue, I'm leaning on those who would be aggrieved against the regulator. My suggestion, therefore, if it is not covered, is that the legal team should consider, if the committee agrees with me, that there is a clause that is protecting the members of the public or the industry against the regulator. That will be my input. Chair, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Manu. Let's deal with the habit as we have agreed that we'll practice it of lowering your hand. Thank you very much. Babu Keta Mabala.
Chair and honorable members, I'm checking chairperson on regulator on clause 16 and clause 17. I'm trying to check the powers of the regulators and the powers of council. Who will have the final weight between the council and the regulators? Because if you check the clause 16.5, after consideration a complaint referred under this section, the council must confirm, set aside, or validate the decision by the regulated entities. If you check that sentence, chairperson, and the other one is that one, they say there's number six, if the council has set aside a decision, a contemplated is subsection 5, the relevant regulated entity must consider the matter afresh, have regarded to council reason for setting aside the decision as was the subject of the complaints and take a new decision. So I'm trying to check between the regulator and then the council who will have the final say, chairperson. Thank you very much.
Chair. Chair.
Honorable Makosini.
Thank you, sir. Let me take this opportunity to thank the officials and yourself and members of the committee. My simple question is with regard to council. Is the council going to sign a code of confidentiality to make sure that the information that is given to them is treated with confidence? Then number two is almost similar to that one of the latter speaker. How are we going to deal with the conflict of interest between the council and the regulator? Are they not going to deal with one matter at the same time? Thank you very much.
Okay. Before we go to the advisors, anybody from the department?
I'm here, Chair.
Thank you very much.
My sincere apologies. I got the two questions quickly before I got locked out. The question is, will the council members sign the confidentiality requirements or form? I can't answer that specifically because I don't know whether it's a standard requirement. We've got a legal person. The other question was the conflict of interest between the regulator and the council. I think there we may have to be specific what exactly we mean there, but the idea of the bill is that the regulator will operate separately or independently from the council, and the decisions which are made by the council would be final. Obviously, following that clause that was just highlighted now in respect of setting aside or taking it back to the regulator or making a final decision, and any complainant who may not be happy with the decision of the council has an opportunity now to via through the judiciary system to appeal or query or against the decision that would have been made by the council. So in a nutshell, we don't foresee any conflict of interest between the regulator and the council, because both entities are operating separately and have their own processes and procedures. And therefore, we don't foresee that, but it may happen practically. I think it's something that the committee can consider, Chair. And lastly, I would request the legal person from our department to say one or two with regard to the confidentiality signatures for the council members. Thanks, Chair.
Is your legal person here? Was that Mr. Masombu?
Good morning, okay. Honorable members. It's Masombu, advocate, talking.
Advocate. Sorry to call you, Mr.
Well, it's all the same, Chair. Nonetheless, Chair, the answer to that is that every employee, when he is employed, he is there are standard procedures, administrative procedures that you need to follow. One of the requirement is that you must fill in a confidentiality clause, and it's a questionnaire form that you sign there that you will not divulge information unnecessary to members of the public or to other interested parties. Thanks.
There we are. Anything from the parliamentary advisor? Or state law advisor?
No further comments, Chair. The department has covered the response. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, if I may come in, it's Masombuga again with regard to 16.3, which was raised by Honorable McDonald.
Yes.
Through your permission. Where it says the council must conduct a hearing, and the question was whether it's not going to cause an administrative burden for the council to always conduct hearing. Maybe we can rephrase that particular 16.3 to say the council must consider and decide whether to conduct a hearing. Because when a matter appears before you, you need to peruse the matter and check as to whether, or the secretariat of the council will have to check as that particular matter as to, is it ripe, is everything available for a hearing to be conducted? Or is it something that can be administratively resolved in an office, maybe by a response, and maybe it does not even require that particular hearing. So they must consider it first as to whether is it due and ripe and ready for a hearing, or whether there is a need for a hearing to be conducted, or is it something that can be dealt with administratively? So we can rephrase that to cover both scenarios. Not always that is that there should be a hearing. Because before a hearing is conducted, you need to peruse and check as to whether does this warrant a hearing or not. So
okay.
That 16.3 can be rephrased to say the council must consider and decide whether the matter is due for hearing or not.
Okay, members, I think let me start with the Honorable McDonald. Does that cover your concern?
Yes. Yes, Chair, that would fully cover me, because that was my concern, that it would be an administrative nightmare to have a hearing for each and every complaint. Thank you, Chairperson.
Can we get a seconder for that? I see the hand of Honorable Manu.
Yes, Chair, but unfortunately not seconding, as I normally do. Chair, I see this clause as trying to protect those who are aggrieved. Hence, I raised my concern earlier, because I don't see anywhere where their people are protected against the regulator. If we go as suggested, then that could also be used by the regulator when people are grieved to say, but we perused the matter and we didn't think there was any reason to conduct a hearing. So here we are dealing with a situation where as legislators, we must try and foresee, as somebody will ask, what was the intent of the legislation or the legislator? I see this as a net that covers to say everybody must feel like their matter has been covered. While I hear what my colleague is saying as an administrative burden, but if it is necessary to make sure that the public are protected, so be it, in my view. Thank you very much, Chairperson. That I didn't second this time. My apologies.
No, if I hear you very well and I try to reconcile your concern with what Honorable MacDonald is raising, Honorable Mangu, is that Honorable MacDonald is saying there may be an unnecessary delay in terms of response from the side of the regulator because of the long queue of people who needs to follow this process that you and Honorable McDee are not agreeing with. And he's saying where people can be responded to and their things, their issues are administrative, that process should be able to take place. As I hear you, is that you are further saying what happens if somebody feels that their issues had weight that needs to be investigated, that will need a hearing. And those issues have just been brushed off and said, no, according to our view, this is a simple matter. It does not need hearing. What? How do we balance the two? I think if I'm correct, let me check first that I'm correct with you before I get to the legal advice and the department.
You summed it up 100%, Chair. 100%.
100%. Are you agreeable also?
I'm 100% agreeable with you, Chairperson.
Okay. Thank you very much. If we are 100% agreeable, let's get to that habit, Honorable Manu, of lowering a hand. Thank you very much. Let's hear advocate.
Chair, what I think might assist,
yes.
If we look at clause 16,
yes,
there is reference here to complaints that look at if the regulator has concluded that a complaint does not raise issues of general economic or public policy concern, or otherwise in terms of section 18. This section 16 also allows the regulator to refer complaints to the council. Now, this will be outside complaints. This will be complaints of the regulated entities, their conduct. So this might be a passenger that wants to complain about the fee or the fares, let's say the monthly fares on PRASA or Metro Rail, while there's a lot of load shedding or cable theft and they cannot use their full monthly ticket, for example.
Yeah.
So that it allows that process. So the council can, on my understanding, look at complaints from outside over regulated entities conduct or pricing, as well as look at complaints about decisions of the regulator. Because if we look at clause section 22 and 23, which is our next one we're getting to under part D, 22 deals with the right to appeal to the council. That will be for decisions made by the regulator. So that could be, in my understanding, a public person, a passenger, or it could even be a regulated entity that then lodges a complaint about a decision of the regulator. And it will also then deal for appeals on these decisions. So Chi, I think the department and our legal advisors can just assist once we're done with Part D and this section, because Part D refers to review of regulators' decisions. So this is now where we have to see whether or not the concerns raised by Mr. Mantku is dealt with in terms of the Act, because this is where, according to how I understand the bill, they seek to give that redress. So okay. Chair, clause 22 will give you the various decisions that can be appealed or that can be considered. And there's also here the requirement for hearings. This is definitely a situation, I think, where you will not be able to do away with the hearing, because this is after all the other processes have been followed, whether it was looking at the facts or the merits of the case and determining in the initial complaint by the council from a, let's say, a member of the public, whether or not it requires a specific hearing. But hearings do take many forms. Hearings can be on the documents or it can be face-to-face hearings. So that's also something that the department can just give some clarity on. Chair, so that I'm going to just go to Part E as well, because it does link up with D, because this gives you the procedures at council hearings. It also gives you the rights to participate in the hearings. And it gives you clause 25, powers of the council at the hearing. This will say that there were some issues in some of the comments on the powers to subpoena, powers to investigate from both the council and the regulator. So we just need to make sure that the department addresses those concerns that some of the submitters raised. Then clause 26 is the rules of procedure. 27 gives the calling of witnesses that they'll be allowed to do. And then clause 28 is the decision at the end of the hearing. So this section, Part D and E, links up with C about those decisions. So this is where we need to make sure that the concerns were addressed, both of what happens if either a regulated entity or passenger is not happy with the decision from the regulator, or what happens if they are not happy about a decision made by the council. And we see here in section or clause 28.6 is that the decisions by the council can be taken on review to the High Court, subject to obviously the High Court rules. And that is what the department has referred to already, that it can be taken on review. So, Chair, I think these section C, D, and E just needs a bit of clarity from the department. Just some concerns. I just went down to the memorandum to the Act that gives a little bit of clarity on the regulatory institutions. So this will say that the bill then establishes our regulator, which is the Transport Economic Regulator. It also does the Transport Economic Council, which is the council we've just been spoken referred to. These will be established as state organs responsible or linked to the minister. And then 4.2, the regulator will be the primary technical, administrative, and enforcement regulator responsible for carrying out education, research, price control, approval, access request, approval, investigations of complaints, and enforcement. These powers will vest in the executive regulatory panel established by clause 34, which we'll still get you, Chair. Then the council will be the primary adjudicative entity. So this seeks to take the matter to a body that is pre-court, pre-court processes. So the council will be the primary adjudicative entity that does reviews on decisions of the regulator when affected party applies for such a review, and reviews decisions of regulated entities when a user of a facility or service provided or licensed by a regulated entity considers that their rights have been adversely affected. So I hope that gives some clarity what the difference is between the two bodies. But again, this is in the memo. We do need to make sure that that same purpose or intent comes out in these clauses, and that the members' concerns are dealt with there, Chair. So I'm just going to get back here to Dee, and then we'll take members' comments or the department's clarification there, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate. Let's get the department, then we'll go to members. Advocate Masombuka is still here.
Chair, I'll leave it to Mr. Mugis to respond to it.
Oh, Mr. Mugis is back. Welcome back, Mr. Sikudo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think, Chair, Advocate Nell has simply and correctly explained the clauses that are in the bill. I think from our side, I think there isn't any further input to make. Not unless there would be questions and comments from the Honorable Members who will then come in and clarify where we think should be clarified.
Thank you very much. Honorable Manu.
Chair, thank you. I hope it's that time where you said you will then invite the members.
Yes,
thank you very much, Chair. Advocate, thank you so much, Advocate Nell, for always simplifying these things. Chair, some colleagues raised the independence between the regulator and the council, which I think is the intent of the legislation. But however, I think we have seen when Parliament, its oversight role has been called to question. Currently it's happening at the Zondo Commission where serious allegations are made about our role, whether we're there or not, it's our role as oversight roles. If you look at Section 46 of the establishment of the Economic Council, it says again, and this question has been coming up quite a couple of times, maybe specifically 47.1, the council comprised of a chairman, each appointed by the minister. And that is where the independence of this council becomes into question. And I don't think we must blind our eyes and not say we are seeing some things that are happening in some of our entities. And I feel very strongly that the intent of the legislation is very clear. It seeks to establish these as independent and seeks to give the council a pre-court process, as the advocate has duly said so. But I still feel there is not enough protection of those that would still want to. Going to court in this country is very, very expensive. And I think we should avoid exposing people who might not have the means to go to court to challenge either the council or the regulator's decisions. So I think the council, as it is presented here, answers my question earlier, as Advocate was saying. However, I still feel that we need to find a very simpler, less expensive, and really independent way of assisting people against any potential collusion between the council and the regulator. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Maybe as we move forward, we may want to look into exactly how that can be coined, and maybe the advisors also could assist us to check if there's any other better way of dealing with this issue of independence and a cheaper way. Can we agree on that, honorable members?
In agreement, Chairperson.
Anybody who's against it? Thank you very much. Any other hand? Okay.
Thank Please comment, Mr. Chair. I did lower my hand on time this time. Thank you, Chair.
You are commended, Honorable Manu. Advocate.
Okay, Chair. I'm sure the department and the legal advisors can have a look at how similar concerns to this extent have been dealt with, even with past bills that the committee dealt with, and see if there's a stronger formulation that can be done, or just make sure that the formulation is correct. And if it is correct in their view, just to confirm that with reference to the sections in the bill that make sufficient provision for it at the next meeting, Chair. If that is in order, then I'm sure we can carry on with Chapter 4, where we get into the appointments and the establishments that Mr. Manku led us into, Chair.
Advocate, you are well in order.
Okay, Chair. Looking at Chapter 4, Part A, we look at the establishment of the Transport Economic Regulator. There were some comments here and there in the submissions about the qualifications that would be needed both for the regulator as well as the council, and to make sure that the bill and the clauses provide sufficiently for that. But just going through the clauses, Section 29 is the establishment. That is the actual staff. So this is the juristic person. It's regarded as independent, subject to the Constitution, must be impartial, and exercise the functions assigned to it in terms of the law. Then going on to the governance, this is how the board of the regulator is set up. We have in the past had some comments from members in various committees at Parliament on whether or not the number of 6 non-executive members is appropriate. Sometimes they like 7, but this we'll have to see from members here. This will also include the chief executive officer, who serves on the board, obviously subject to Section 11, or subsection 11. Then before the appointment, this is the process that the minister needs to follow. Chairperson will see this is quite in line with the board appointments for other transport type regulators or councils that we currently have in the legislation. From our strategic planning, members will also recall that unlike some other committees, this transport committee is not necessarily involved in terms of the statutory appointment of board members. We often receive the list of nominations that the minister then sends to cabinet for approval and appointment at the end of the day. I'm not sure if members seeks to work towards amending that. I know members want more input in regulations set up by the minister, but this is for the committee to decide. Currently, it is the appointment process via invitation and advertising. establishment of a panel of experts to do the selection and to look at those. Again here, subclause 4, within 20 business days from date of appointment of the non-executive members, the minister must publish a notice of such appointment. I don't see a time frame set up in this bill. Members will recall the committee's had quite a few frustrations in terms of how long it has taken in some instances for the department to make sure that their board appointments are completed. That is just a committee concern that has popped up that I'd like to flag for members. These appointed board members serve on a part-time basis for a term of 4 years. In some other areas, it is 3 years. Some other bodies will have it as 5 years. So members often in the legislation do give their view on whether or not the term of the board is sufficient or suitable. There's a simultaneous turnover of board's non-executive members. And they must be varied so that some are appointed to serve for 3 years and the remainder for 4 years. This is the concern that often comes up in committees to make sure that there is some form of carryover of the knowledge and the expertise so that you don't have a completely fresh or new board coming in with every turnover. They can be reappointed for a second term. That is quite standard in most of the board appointments that we do see. Then they do the designation of the chairperson, and subclause 9 is the functions of the board, what they seek to provide there. Subsection 10, board must not interfere with the decisions of the executive regulatory panel. That is also quite standard. Again, here we see a bit on the CEO's appointment and his voting privileges. The frequency of meetings of the board, at least once every 3 months, establishment of the quorum, and the proceedings of the board to take decisions, what number of members need to be there for their decision taking. Members will see the next section is on the qualification of the board members. Some of the submissions queried what is the definition of suitably qualified. There is this added caveat here on relevant experience in transport, economics, law, accounting, public finance, and governance. That is also a standard clause that we do see. There is normally an argument about the word or whether it should be or and, but or is normally better because it's very hard to get somebody that has all of those experiences in one CV. So the use of or is normally selected for that phrasing there. There's a written declaration regarding whether or not they would be disqualified from being on the board. That would be any interests in the bodies. The conflicts is dealt with under clause 32, as well as disqualifications here. This is also a standard clause used for most board appointments on the disqualifications. And it carries on all the way. The whole subsection 2 will deal with the disqualifications. On the conduct and conflicts of board members, this is the declarations that even staff members will often have to make. But this is also to look at when they're taking a decision if there's any interest coming in. And how they need to remove themselves from those decisions and what the process is there. clause 33 on the resignation and removal. There is 3 months written notice, and if less than 3 months written notice is there, this can be done with approval from the minister. Members can just consider whether or not the 3 months is suitable. I'm sure the department will give some input on that. It does seem as a standard notice period. These are the actions that will lead to such removal from office. The minister must afford them an opportunity to state the defense of the position as to why they should not be removed, if it's a removal and not a resignation. Then there must be the filling of the vacancy and how that will run once a new person is appointed in that position. Subclause 34 is the regulator's executive structures. So this, if members refer to the organogram that the department presented in the financial impact presentation, this is where we need to see if the Act links up with the proposed organogram. We have the chief executive officer that recommends to the board for the filling of three positions of executive officers in that organogram. Then going to the appointment of the chief executive officer, there's details on how this is done by the board and governance thereof. If members look at the appointment here, this is the executive officer's duties on what they can do. I just want to check here on the appointment of the executive officer. We often find, I don't see an indication here that the appointment of the executive officer is dependent on getting input from the minister. I don't know if this was an oversight or if I'm just not, if I'm misreading it. That is often a practice that is done through the boards, that prior to the appointment of the executive officers, they do get input from the minister's office on making that appointment. In some aspects, that even goes as far as having the possible appointee to the post being sent to cabinet. The department should just provide some clarity here for members or whether or not this is the correct formulation as it is in this bill. If members are happy with the board taking that decision on its own, then members can just indicate that. I'm just reflecting on what is the practice and what does happen currently. It does seem that the bill is a little bit different in that aspect. The powers of the executive officer is there, subclause 35, and how they can appoint and how they participate. Then the appointment of the other executive officers, subclause 36. These are fixed term based for 5 years, it seems. They may be reappointed on expiry of each term. This does not say whether it's only for one second term or whether or not this is a practice that could possibly lead to a seemingly permanent appointment. We'll just need some clarity on that, because there are some issues if you do not renew a contract of an executive officer while you one executive officer while you do actually renew the contract of others. There could be concerns raised on legitimate expectation of having their contract renewed. So we do need some clarity on whether or not this reappointment is going to be linked to only two terms, or whether or not this can be linked to performance assessments to make sure that if the person is reappointed, that it is based on performance, so that there's proper grounds if another executive officer is not having their contract renewed, just to cover concerns of legitimate expectations of reappointment. Subclause 37 on resignation or removal of executive officers, that is also a standard clause. The functions of the regulators in subclause 38. General provisions concerning the regulator. We do see here regulator, after consultation with the minister, may issue directives relating to the functions of the regulator. So here we also see the concerns that were raised on access to confidential information. So hopefully in terms of the directives that they issue, the concerns pointed out in the submissions will also be covered as an additional fail-safe, other than the clauses that are provided on dealing with confidential information. Subclause 4 deals with the remuneration, benefit, and conditions of employment within the regulator. Clause 40 on the development of codes of practice relating to the Act. This, for example, is also an area where a code of confidentiality can be brought in. This just allows the regulator to develop their codes that will be applicable to the staff, as well as the board and the executives. Subclause 41 on the promotion of legislative and regulatory reform. So this does look at the other legislation on regulation of transport facilities and services as well, if they do exist or come in from time to time. This does also refer to our international agreements or any other national provincial legislation that they do need to consider in the work that they do. Chair, subclause 42 on their research and public information. This is where some of the concerns hopefully are also addressed on how do people access the decisions from the regulator, as well as whether it's decisions from a dispute or decisions on the tariff or the fare determinations or the costs or the other costs considerations that came in. So these aspects and these decisions do need to be published in terms of the regulator's work. If they do have the information on statistical data, again, this is where the Access to Information Act comes in, where some people might put their access to information request to the regulator on some of the data that they've collected, some of the research. The regulator can also go so far in their policy documents to determine information sharing with universities or transport economists or other bodies internationally that does similar work to theirs. So that clause will deal with their research and the access to the information, how they can do their research as well. Going into subclause 43 on regulations with other regulatory authorities, this is their interrelationships that they will have, and this is where our big concern or the big discussion comment will also be on the how their relationship will be or how their decisions will be in considering the work that's also done by the Competition Commission. This clause, I think, will have a lot of debate based on the interest we've received on the submissions. Both verbal submissions and the written submissions, and some of the concerns that the committee raised on what will happen, or if it is possible, number one, and what will happen if a person does lodge a dispute at the same time on the same matter to both the Competition Commission as well as a regulator, just to alleviate how that will occur. So we need to have input from the legal advisors as well as the department on whether or not clause 43 does address all the concerns raised in the submissions, or whether or not it needs to be beefed up in order to cover those concerns. it is quite an extensive clause. Then just almost done with this part, Chair, sub-clause, clause 44, advice and recommendations by the minister. This is where the minister comes into some of the work that the regulator does. We do see the word here, may, in addition to any other advice or reporting requirements set out in the Act, the regulator may advise the minister on matters related to economic regulation of transport facilities and services, of any substantive changes to the structural competitiveness of any transport market facility or service, or in respect of any matter referred to by the minister. So this is above and beyond. This is additional information that they can send to the minister. Quite necessary because a lot of the policy work and the specifications of some of the transport sector access that is done is needed by the department if we have, for example, transport facility information or regulation of those facility information. So this could assist in household travel survey information sharing. So all of that can assist the department in its research in order to further their policy and further how they work with the different transport facilities and legislation going forward. There's also a recommendation that they may make to the minister on changes to bring about uniformity in legislation in various provinces in relation to transport facilities and services, and inquire into and report to the minister on any matter concerning the purpose of this act. Then clause 45, the minister may call for inquiries or investigations by notice in the Gazette. The minister may request the regulator to conduct a market inquiry. And the minister may also give a written direction to the regulator to investigate any matter or circumstances with respect to the purposes of this act, whether or not those circumstances appear at a time of the direction to amount to a possible contravention of the act, or consult with the regulator on any matter arising under this act. This is also quite important, Chair, because as you know, or as members would know, quite often the first port of call for concern by a member of the public is to either the MMC, the MEC, or the minister's office to deal with an issue, regardless of whether or not it's a municipal road or provincial road or national road. And those officers do need to seek to address and assist as best they can. So this may, if a complaint goes to the minister, instead of going to the regulator, this will allow the minister just to forward that and to request the regulator to look at those issues and any other issues that the minister may deem fit. So I'm going to pause there before we carry on because that is quite a mouthful and there's quite a few issues here for members to consider before we move forward.
Thank you, Advocate. This was indeed quite a mouthful, as we are saying. Let me get to hear the view of the committee on this matter of appointments. Honorable Stole will be followed by Honorable Manu, and will also be followed by Honorable Makosini Chabangu in Ekwakwa. Mondis? Job? Unmute yourself so that we can hear you.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, I was trying to check the period of members of the board members. If they are say 4 years, if that can be 3 years, I think I can be happy because we remember what happened when the officials are in the board members are in the office for a long time. They become so stubborn. and do something that is corrupt the entity. I think so. And the other chairperson, I was checking the membership. If they say the members should be six, because my thinking is that if they are seven, because they have to have a chairperson and a deputy chairperson, so that when the chairperson is not there, the deputy will be there for the meeting. And I think, Chair, so far, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mfanagit. Let's get the Honorable Mfen.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and Advocate, for taking us through there. Chair, I think this is a time to be bold. I'm not saying we have not been bold. In my earlier input, I alluded to the issues that Parliament, its oversight role, and the committees has been found wanting. If you look in the transport space, we know ourselves what we have been seeing or observing within, for instance, PRASA board, where the portfolio committee or parliament had absolutely no role in the appointment of that board, and yet it's such a critical transport backbone infrastructure for this country. I think it's a very, very big mistake. I think we should seriously consider, following the line of the SABC Board, Section 13, I think, of the SABC Board Act, which gives the authority to the President after the recommendation of Parliament of appointment of boards. This, I think, calls for us to consider that. Why? Because, number one, this bill, once it becomes an act, will going to have a huge impact on the ease of doing business in South Africa, the cost of doing business, and all the things that this particular act seeks to achieve. I think that is also highlighted by the fact that the President, in his 2020 State of the Nation Address, highlighted this particular bill. The Minister of Finance highlighted this particular bill as a game changer. And yet Parliament doesn't have a role, for instance, to appoint a board. I think we must take the bull by the horn and ensure that the appointment of this board will be in line with acts such as the SABC Act and so forth. That is my first fundamental strong recommendation, given the background that I have given. We might not see its results, but I think we will be setting a very, very strong foundation as this committee in the fifth parliament for those that will be coming ahead of us. Now, if you talk to governance, the issues that were dealt with, the number of board members and so forth, which are very articulated there, I think those, as the advocate was saying, that there are more standards, and I will assume that they try and align with the codes of practice, King 4, and many others that are out there. But what is very interesting clause 30, I believe it's still a clause, not a section yet, or section 30.12. Says the board must meet at least once every 3 months at a place and time determined by the chairperson. You know, Chairperson, I heard of one of the transport boards of our Department of Transport that between the 13th of January and the end of January, they met 16 times at a cost of more than R1 million. And it questions the impact or the effectiveness of what we are putting in these pieces of legislation. you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And I will raise it. I'm making it as an example, not to move away from this. Chair, it's time that Parliament and its committees take charge of legislation in this country if we are to stop what we are seeing out there. But that one of that board, I will talk to you some other time on it. Qualifications of board membership, I don't have any input. Conduct and conflict, and has been said, resignation, removals, I'm fairly fine with it. And I want to jump without delaying too much to where I would like to make another comment, which is in 43, section or clause 43, whatever we want to call that to be. It calls about research and public information. And I want to talk to 43, relations with other regulatory. 43B in particular says, the regulator must liaise with any entity that has jurisdiction over safety issues within the transportation sector in order to harmonize the exercise of jurisdiction over transportation matters. I am of the view that subject to clarification, that is misplaced. This is a transport economic regulator, not safety regulator. If I'm correct, the rail safety regulator will continue its functions once this is established as a safety regulator. However, if there's anything within the RSR or any other regulator that relates to economic regulation, that will be moved to this particular entity. And if my understanding is correct, then that clause is misplaced there. 43, 1A. Let's talk, maybe I'll talk 43, 1A and B, but let me start with 43, 2A. At any time, the regulator on its own initiative or on the response of the request from the minister in terms of subsection 45.1, which is a very interesting read also, may request the Competition Commission to consider whether particular entity, markets, facilities, services within the transport sector are failing to function competitively or are characterized by anti-competitive abuses. This is at the heart of what many people were raising to say, can you clearly separate the function of this regulator to the Competition Commission? Here, you hear now all of a sudden the regulator is going to go to the same Competition Commission and ask it on certain things. Clarity is sought by myself there, or we must understand the separation between what this regulator. Let us read it together with 43.1A, just above that, which says the regulator must negotiate and conclude an agreement with the Competition Commission to coordinate and harmonize the exercise of jurisdiction over competition matters and to ensure consistent application of the principles of this Act. Chair, I think here, legal people must help me understand what exactly we are saying here. We are establishing a regulator who we are giving powers and everything. Getting an agreement with the Competition Commission, I think it's well and good. But what, that agreement should be doing for me in line also read with 42A is something that we need much, much better explanation. Now, I want to read that together with 45 that is mentioned there of what the minister may do. I think it says 45.1, which I'm running to very quickly, which says the minister, by notice in the Gazette, may request the regulator to conduct a market inquiry in terms of section 43.2. Let's go back again to 43. where the regulator is asking the commission to do exactly the same thing, if my interpretation is correct. I think it's 43.2. Yes, in terms of 45.1, may request the competition to consider whether particular entities. So 43.1.2 and its subsections and 45 for me makes a lot of need to reconsider and understand exactly what it is. In terms of 44 advice and recommendations to the minister, I think I'm fine, because obviously some of them are dependent of the outcome of the above issues that I've raised. A minister may call for inquiries and investigations. Again, the regulator to conduct a market inquiry. On the other side, the Competition Commission also may be asked to do exactly the same thing. Chairperson, I want to pause it there, but I want to urge committee members that my original submission, that it's time on such a bill that all of us would agree, I hope, that it is a game changer in the transportation of this country and the future. We cannot leave Parliament outside of the process of appointing a board. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Jambas, for your extensive participation. Baba
Umatiwa. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I think Comrade Manu has said them all, but fortunately he has left me with one. Chairperson, I'm not trying to be personal, but my simple question would be, why are the regulators or members of the board always consisting of senior citizens? Is it because of the need of experience, or is it just to give work to members who have resigned from their work and have served the government with dignity? And this might be the cause or reason why our entities are failing to perform 100%. I think the board members should also be paid according to their yearly performance. If not, no performance, no payment. Thank you, Chief.
That's serious. Honorable McDonald.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I want to add my voice to what Honorable Mangchu, my learned friend, has alluded to regarding the appointment of the board members with a parliamentary process. And I think that it's high time that the boards of the transport portfolios also become subject to parliamentary intervention. Chairperson, I'm also in agreement with what he said regarding the Competitions Commission, because the way that it's currently reading is that the Competitions Commission will then still be doing the work of the regulator. And if that is the fact, then what is the point of the regulator? Because if the Competition Commission is still going to do the work of regulating the things and the transport sector and the competition within. So, Chairperson, I think those reference to both in 43 and 45 regarding the Competitions Commission need to be rephrased or changed. Then, Chairperson, there's no, in the appointment of this board, there's no provision for an interim board in the whole bill. So what do we do when we appoint, when we haven't got a complete board? Can then the whole regulator is dysfunctional? So Chairperson, those are my submissions. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Let's get in the habit of lowering our hands. Thank you, Mondise. Ngicela wehlise isandla ba. Job, isandla sakho siyangihlupha emoyeni mfowethu. Honorable members, thank you. I think maybe I should also raise a concern here and see how do we go about dealing with it. Once this bill is turned into a fully functional act, it means this regulator will then take charge and be in charge of all the entities. What mechanisms are we going to do? Maybe the department can help us there to ensure that there are no massive job losses or job losses at all. Because as we speak, we have a number of chairpersons, a number of positions that are there already. How are we going to mitigate in ensuring that people do not just lose jobs because there is now a new structure in place? I don't want to deal with the issues of finances. I think we'll deal with them next week. But I would love if the department can respond to that and try and say what do they have in mind. Otherwise, let me, before I let me hand over to the department and the advisors, then we'll come back to the issue of Honorable Manu's proposal that has been seconded already by Honorable Can we get the department to respond where they need to respond?
Good morning, Chair. I'm in.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zikudo.
Thank you, Chair. The question is well noted as to what would happen with the current board members in the main and the employees. Suffice to have presented in the previous session to indicate that the HR process plan and procedures will be unpacked as part of the second phase. However, first phase of this project would be to start the single transport economic regulator using the ports regulator as well as the regulating committee. Can you hear me, Chair?
I can hear you very clearly. I was just trying to check who was disturbing you, and I think I'll be able to get to that person and mute him properly. Yes, you can continue.
Chair, I couldn't hear a thing there. My face is right next to the laptop, trying to speak loud as well. I don't know whether members can hear me.
And members can hear you well, Mr. Scudo.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The first phase of this process is to start the single transport economic regulator using the ports regulator, which is a permanent body, which has a part-time board members as well as the regulating committee that has part-time members. The first thing that the department continues to do is to factor in the fact that the bill will at some point be enacted, and therefore when the appointment of the Ports Regulator Board is basically done, there is a consideration of factoring the fact that the appointment would either be for a period of 3 years, subject to the enactment of this bill, and just at the board level, meaning that there is a consideration of the fact that the transport regulator will be in place at some point in time, and therefore when you renew the tenure of the board members for the ports regulator, therefore that is factored in. So the renewal is not on a lengthy period of time. And secondly, the regulating committee, which is also a part-time body, a similar method is in place by the department. So therefore, the board members of the port regulator and the would be considered when the start of the regulator is in place to put the board members. At the current moment, we're looking at 5 members, and some of those members. Some of their contracts would be so that we have those with experience could be maintained to basically operate as an interim board and then invite new members to be part of the board. So in general, whenever a board is replaced or renewed, the department considers as to whether and projects as to when the would be enacted. Normally we then say we can't be exactly there. That's normally what we do. But the real story is that what we have done, the meeting we had on the 17th of November, we've done a small synopsis analysis of the HR impact. And what we identified was that the initial anticipated 78 people for the regulator would be more than what the 65 members or employees that exist at the current moment. But indeed, it was one of the areas that the department is always considering to make sure that whoever who's put on the board would be considered for future board of the Single Transport Economic Regulator Chair. So that has been one of the questions that has been raised also by other board members. So phase two will then consider the licensing councils. In the main, those licensing board members part-time as well, whenever we renew their contract in place. And then phase three would be where we put in place the cross-border road transport agency, as well as the National Public Transport Regulator, as well as those ones. There's a factoring of the transport economic regulator consideration. So we strike a balance of the existing board members that we want to, as well as the ones that we would want to consider for the transport economic regulator chair. So, but the bone of contention that we need to put a proper plan is the plan, particularly for the employees, and most of which is a secretarial function, which is based in the department. I'm now talking about the part-time bodies like the licensing councils, the regulating committee, in exclusion of the port regulator of South Africa, in exclusion of the cross-border road transport agency. But overall, issue of employment by the department is of importance as well. Thank you, Chair.
We are losing you, Mr. Miyaketsi.
Chair, I'm here.
Okay, thank you very much.
I don't know whether you got my response. In a nutshell, we were saying we strike a balance between the existing board members of all the regulators in a phased approach, vis-a-vis the anticipated transport economic regulator. So the renewal of the board members basically factors as to the anticipation of when the transport economic regulator will be in place. And secondly, we are of the view that employment creation is important an indication that we have done is that post the meeting we held on financial implication presentation, we then did a small assessment as to what exactly the employment will be when we are anticipating 78 employees that we presented in the last meeting. We got an indication that the current status or the status quo analysis is that there's about or approximately about 65 employees which will be affected, and which therefore means if indeed the HR plan is put in place, there's a possibility of employing more persons vis-a-vis reducing the number of employees, Chair. That's where I will stop. Thank you, Chair. I hope you heard me.
We heard you very well. Mr. Nekedi Sekudo, thank you very much. Let's get the parliamentary advisor. If you have anything, Ms. Tilosin Kangen.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regards to the comment by the Honourable Member Manku, those two comments, may I deal with those now?
Yes.
Okay, so with regards to the two section 43.2 and section 45.1, I am in agreement that these sections don't make sense given the given what the ERT bill is trying to do. I understand that there will be a memorandum of agreement between the regulator and the Competition Commission that would determine the respective jurisdictions and functions and competencies, but those two sections don't make sense whichever way I look at it. So I think we'd need to go back to those two sections. With regards to Parliament's involvement and oversight, we can look at the sections and possibly amend them to add whenever it refers to the minister, we could say in consultation with Parliament, and that would then allow us to be at the forefront and as involved as possible. We could look at doing something along those lines. I think that's important so we could go through the bill as a whole and just have a look at where we could change and amend and add, just to bolster our oversight function, especially with regards to the board and board members and that sort of thing. And then with regards to, there's no provision for an interim board. There is a clause that speaks about not an interim board, but deals with a vacancy of a board member, and it says that the minister needs to within 30 days, I think. I just need to find that section again, but it does make provision for the appointment of fulfilling of a vacancy. And that's all I have to say at this stage, Chair. Thank you.
We can see your hands moving, Ms. Kangen, but we can't hear your voice. Maybe you have muted yourself.
Chair, can you hear me?
Ms. Kangen? Yeah, I'm sure we've lost her.
Hello, good morning, Chair. Apologies for being late. She's not muted. You can hear her. I think the...
Unmute yourself, Mr. Anishwa, if you want to say something.
I think
can we get
the issue is on your side.
The state law advisor.
Chair, we don't have anything
further.
Yes, Chair. We don't have anything further to add, Chair. Yeah, I'm in agreement with the comments by the Parliamentary Law Advisor. Thanks.
Can you hear me, Honourable Members?
Loud and clear, Chair. Loud and clear.
We can hear you, but looks like you can't hear us.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Chair. Even Ms. Gangen, we can hear her. You can hear us.
Yeah. I have a problem here.
Can you please log out?
I've unmuted myself. So the problem is not on my side. Maybe I should quickly change to another gadget.
No, it's on your side.
This.
On your side.
Can see members very happy. Just a minute so that I can change and use another gadget.
Waiting. Can Honorable Hun Singh lead us in a song while we are waiting for the chair? Can Honorable Hun Singh lead us in a song while we are waiting for the chair?
Go for a spot of matter, everyone.
This is not a spot for the parliament.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, Chairperson, we can hear you.
Chairperson, you've got two devices connected. You are echoing.
You must switch off one device.
Are you there, Mr. Kangen? Hello? I was saying, Ms. Kangen can continue, and sorry that I disorganized you. The problem was with my...
Chair. Gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I can hear you now.
Sorry, Chair. This internet has really been troubling today. Sorry about that. I've made my comments. Would you like me to just repeat them for your benefit, Chair?
Just at the end, maybe I lost you when you were... pointing to a particular section, I could just see the pointing.
Okay.
So the very last comment I made, and an advocate now flagged it on the screen for me. Thank you. That said, that provision is made for the appointment of a board member when there is a vacancy. So that would deal with any vacancies on the board itself. And that was all I had to say in respect of those two comments, Chair, for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Let's hear the State Law Advisor, Ms. R. Hercher. Honourable members, mute yourself, please. Ms. R. Hercher-en, are you with us?
Yes, Chair.
Let's allow you to say something.
I have nothing further to add, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable members, proposal was made, and we have heard from the legal point of view that is possible by Honorable Mang, that we should seek to be part of, as Parliament, to be part of the appointment of the board, put nicely by the parliamentary advisor, that the minister should do this thing in consultation with Parliament. Any agreement on this? Let me see hands.
Agreed.
Anybody who's not in favor of this?
Chairperson, can I just add something?
Yes, a long time.
No, thanks so much. I think just something quick. When they say that in consultation with Parliament, obviously that would be a reference to the Portfolio Committee on Transport, unless if I have it wrong.
I also take it that we are an arm of Parliament, and that is by extension us.
But yeah, I think for good measure, wouldn't it be, or maybe it would, I'm not sure, maybe I can get advice from the state law advisors and everyone else who's here, shouldn't it explicitly say that in consultation with the Portfolio Committee on Transport? Because if you leave it open like that, it's Parliament, that means Parliament, maybe through a process, they can appoint an ad hoc committee or anything like that, it remains the function of the speaker. But if the state law advisors are happy that when we leave it to say in consultation with Parliament, by default it means in consultation with the Portfolio Committee on Transport, then there's no problem. But if it just says Parliament, then I think it's just open. I can take advice from colleagues and the legal team from there. On the line. Thanks so much, Chair, for indulging me.
Honourable members, there is a suggestion that we should be explicit in terms of what we are saying. I see hands. Honourable Manu, Honourable Hunsinger, and Honourable Stone.
Chair, thank you very much. I think my reference to the SABC Act was trying to deal with that. It's not in consultation. It is exactly my proposal, the way that the board of SABC is appointed. It is the committee that issues the invites. It is the committee that interviews, and it makes a recommendation. Once Parliament agrees, it sends to the President to sign. So consultation means when you feel like, you know, you cannot, and when I consult with you, it doesn't mean I must take your view. I have consulted you. So I think my recommendation was very explicit, and I still stand by it. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we are in support of a dispensation similar to the Broadcasting Act 4 of 1999, where in fact the Portfolio Committee handles the interviews and make the appointment of the board. The justification for this would be that this would be an organ of state that needs to function as far as possible independent of the state, although it sounds ironic. And furthermore, it should then therefore represent board members that clearly reflect in terms of process of appointment this arm's length from state control. And therefore, Chairperson, I would support the suggestion and recommendation, and also then request that this be changed so that space is made for the Portfolio Committee to be part of the appointment process. In fact, do the interviews and then recommend a list upon which the final appointment can be made. Thank you, Chairperson.
Bondise, thank you, Honorable Unsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have been covered, Chairperson.
Who has covered you, sir?
It's Honorable Mang.
Okay, thank you very much. So we are all in agreement with what Honorable Manu has said.
Yes, sir.
Let me say for the last time, anyone who does not agree.
Chair, it's the special advisor for here, Chair, if I may just make one comment.
Yes, you are allowed.
Chair, if possible, maybe it's possible to get further instructions from the department in regards to the appointment of the board in this regard. If that's possible, take further instructions from them. And just to come back to the committee on this issue, whilst I could take into account similar legislation which is applicable to the economic bill, if that may be in order to come back to this point, please, Chair.
Chair, you are quiet.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm saying for as long as this proposal is noted that it is a proposal of the committee, there shouldn't be a problem of coming back to this issue and thrashing it to its logical conclusion, maybe next week. I don't think members will have a problem with that. Members, am I checking? Yes.
Chairperson, it's not a proposal. It was a decision by the committee, Chairperson.
I'm saying for as long as it is noted, I think the request is that we should give the state law advisor an opportunity to try and see if we are in the right direction, and I don't think that should be a problem. We're not changing anything. They are asking us to finalize this at a later stage, maybe next week or next of next week.
Chair, if I may come in as advocate now.
Yes, advocate.
Chair, I'm just looking at the Broadcasting Act at the moment. Just to give members an idea of what the wording could possibly look like, it is section 13 of the Act that reads 13.1 to say that the 12 non-executive members of the board must be appointed by the president on the advice of the National Assembly. That is how the statutory appointments are normally phrased in the bills that do come to committees for consideration. Currently, as I indicated in my presentation earlier, none of the statutory board appointments that are done under the Ministry of Transport at this point in time in terms of the legislation comes to us or is done by the president on the advice of the National Assembly. It will assist in taking some... it will assist us in the process going forward next week if we can just get some input from the state law advisor. But given the concern that the members did raise on the importance of the bill and the fact that this bill affects quite a few financial institutions, I think it would be wise in looking at this. Because clause 2, subsection 2 of... that bill also indicates that the board appointments should be in a manner which allows for participation by the public in the nomination process, transparency and openness, and that a short list of candidates for the appointment is published, taking into account the objects and principles of the Act. The president must then designate one of the members of the board referred to in that nomination as the chairperson and another member as deputy chair. So that 13.3 can be played with unless the members want a carbon copy of what the Broadcasting Act does say. They might it might just be uncharted territory because we don't have this currently in the Department of Transport for the committee, but it does exist in various other committees, Chair. Then just before we move to the next part, Chair, if the department can just give the clarity or refer to their slide 16 that they presented yesterday on some of the concerns that were raised on the jurisdiction concurrency with the Competition Commission. Out of the comments and the issues that I raised in going through these clauses, they just did not address the Competition Commission concerns. If they can just give some clarity there, Chair.
Let me, before giving the department, say, I'm sure the committee will agree with the suggestion that let's have that formulation properly, and we then can agree with the formulation at a later stage. A decision has been taken, of course, by the committee. That is clear. And with that, let's then move to your suggestion, advocate. The department.
Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Earlier, the committee had taken a decision that matters in relation to relationships with other authorities, that includes the Competition Commission, would have to be looked at again, so that it is clearly defined as to what is the role of the Competition Commission and what is the role of the regulator as well as other regulatory authorities, which the department is comfortable to do that. Suffice to indicate that, Chair, these clauses 43, clause 43 and others related to the Competition Commission, Chair, were engaged with the Competition Commission so that you, at least you are aware that there were two or three bilateral sessions with Competition Commission, and the indication was that they are comfortable with how the bill has been captured. And there's a subsequent report that we, or commentary from the Competition Commission that we have received. Lastly, from my side, Chair, we see the different role that would be played by the Competition Commission, as well as supporting the anticipated regulator in its endeavor to regulate the transport sector in totality. There would be areas which the Competition Commission may not basically participate in, particularly on ex-ante economic regulatory matters, which would be the focus of the transport economic regulator. And the focus of the Competition Commission, I emphasize, is on post-sector economic regulation. And this is it's not a new model. It exists in other sectors of the economy in South Africa as well as internationally, Chair. But yes, I think we can work with the parliamentary officers to basically clarify and address the concerns mainly raised by the honourable members, Chair. I thank you.
Advocate.
Okay, Chair, if members are happy for us to then carry on to part B, which is where we look at the council and the establishment members, of the council.
Members are happy with the fact that this clause will be looked into between the department and the legal team that is here. Advocate.
Okay, Chair, then we carry on to part B, which is matters related to the council. Clause 46 is on the establishment of the council, again indicating, as it was in the memorandum, that it is an organ of state within the public administration. But as an institution outside of the public service, it seeks to be independent and subject to the constitution and legislation, must be impartial and perform functions without fear, favor, and prejudice, quite similar to what is expressed for the regulator itself. Then on the council members, clause 47, it comprises of a chairperson and has no fewer than 5 and no more than 9 other members. This is also normally a standard clause, which allows for some play if there is vacancies so that the council can still carry on and deal with the hearings and the matters at hand if it's not a full component of 9 members. Before making the appointment, the minister, by notice in the Gazette, must call for nominations of persons from members of the public. The members of the council must comprise of sufficiently suitably qualified persons. Again, some of the submissions required clarity on what would be sufficiently suitably qualified, but it does indicate here again that they need to have experience in law, economics, accounting, and the transport industry. Chair, this is where the difference comes in. In terms of the board, there was an or. Here, in terms of the council members, we see and. We might just need some clarity there from our drafters, whether or not that would be advisable, and whether or not we will be able to get council members that have all of these competencies in one person, or whether or not we should consider changing this and to all. The persons may not be appointed or continue to serve as a member if that person is subject to any disqualifications. They serve on a full-time or a part-time basis as determined by the minister. The minister then in turn determines the time each member is appointed, what the members do, whether they are to be full-time or part-time, and look at the term of office. Each member of the council serves for a term of 4 years. And then when the first appointments are made or at any time there's a complete or simultaneous turnover in membership, the terms of the council may be varied to serve for 3 years and the remainder for four. This is different to the board chair where there was no reference to full-time appointments in the board appointments. One can understand why in some instances you might want some full-time members in the council, especially if they get to have a high workload in terms of complaints and public hearings that they have to address to be sure that those persons will be available and that they're not constantly dependent on whether or not they can sit because of other commitments. They may be reappointed for one further term, similar to how the board appointment is. Again, there's the 3-month notice for resignation or on minister's approval for a shorter notice. Any possible interest or conflict of interest must be declared. The minister must remove a member if these circumstances exist. And if they cease to hold office before the end of the term, the minister may, after the due process, appoint another person to serve the remainder of that term. Chair members will give their input on the council appointment if we compare it to the board's appointment to make sure that they are happy with the terms as well as what possibly disqualifies council appointments. Then looking at the functions and procedures, they consider and determine referrals of complaints, referrals of consent agreements, appeals or applications for review. And here we see it on determinations or rulings of the regulator, but the issue of complaints, these can be from complaints against regulated entities. Similar to the discussion we had earlier, they do play a dual role that they look at complaints regarding behavior of regulated entities, and they also look at complaints against the regulator. Here again, they must conduct a hearing, so the previous comments will have to link back and make sure that there's a consequential amendment if we look at considering whether or not a hearing is necessary based on the merits. Then also, the chairperson of the council must manage the caseload of the council. This is, one could argue, an attempt to see whether or not there is, that this could serve as the determination whether or not a hearing has to carry on, similar to what the courts use in their pre-trial hearings or their case management systems that they apply. There's also an additional requirement here that there has to be at least one member of the panel that has legal training and experience, and there must be a member designated to preside over the proceedings. Again, here on application by interested persons may determine whether a decision of the regulator is to be suspended pending the outcome of council proceedings. So Chair, this is a little bit different because in some instances when you appeal a decision, the decision stays and it's not implemented until the appeal is finalized, whereas in this case, the chairperson of the panel or the member designated as chairperson may determine whether or not that decision is suspended pending the outcome. We might need to get some of members' input in there and perhaps some advice from the legal advisors on whether or not that would be in line with practice of appeals and reviews. Chair, I am just going to go to part C because it also attaches to them regarding their conflict of interest. Similar to what we had in the board, they do need to declare any conflict of interest, and this will indicate how they remove themselves from a particular hearing or remove themselves in total from the council, and possibly create a vacancy in that regard. And then we'll get back to the finances, Chair. I just think this conflict of interest clause might possibly be better suited under the section just above Part C, because it does link up with that entire section regarding the council, because the finances is where we get into the financial considerations of how these guys are set up and how the regulator will be run. So, Chair, I'd like to just stop there before Clause 50 for members' input on the council.
Thank you, Advocate. Let me see hands. I see the hand of Honorable Mann. Go on, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Mangete.
Jamba.
Thank you, Advocate. After this advocate process, please get me a paralegal qualification. I think I've been tutored very well. On a more serious note, 46 establishment, I think I've made my comment earlier when I was referring to other things further up. So I will pass there and go to Council Members 47. In particular, I am on 47 subsection 4. It says a person may not be appointed or continue to serve as a member of the council if that person is subject to any disqualification that would apply to a member of the board as set out in section 31(2). With your indulgence, Chair, I would like us to go back then to section 31(2) and hear where what it says, and I will make my substantial input there. Subsection 31(2) says a person may not be appointed to remain as a non-executive. In particular, A says is an office bearer of any party. Personally, it says has or acquires a direct financial interest. If you go to, I'd marked it, let me just go through a couple of them. It's C, that is where my first comment is. Is subsection C2C is related to a person who has an interest in or is a director of a business or enterprise contemplated in paragraph B, which is just above us there. I have a concern regarding is related to a person who has an interest. Now, if you look at some other pieces of legislation, in this particular instance, the Municipal Finance Management Act, I think to a greater extent, the Public Finance Management Act specifically will tell you who is a relative. It tells you it's a spouse and blah, 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 blah. And then when it says if you are related, you cannot adjudicate on a procurement process, it has told you who is defined as a relative. Now here it just says a related person. Who is a related person? I think that's very vague. If it cannot be explained, I propose it be removed. I continue. E says, is subject to an order of a competent court holding the person to be mentally unfit. I'm fine with that. My interest is... H actually says has been removed from an office of trust by a competent authority. Who is a competent authority and what is an office of trust? If it is defined in our definitions, I'm happy to go back there and read it. However, my further proposal is that when we answer that by those who can assist me, the drafters, we could please consider, I will give you a practical example. We had people that were removed by the minister at PRASA, for instance, for reasons that the minister said. And can that person rock up now and become a member of the board of the regulator or be a council member? How do we circumvent that? Or are we saying the competent authority in this case would have been the minister and they were removed in that office of trust? Those would be my comments, Chairperson, up to there. The rest, the resignations and so forth, I'm relatively fine. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Member, Honorable Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just 3 points of clarity. The first one is section 46, 46 sub 1, which says, but an institution outside the public service. Would that then exclude this council from being affected by the PFMA as a question? Secondly, there's reference to terms in section 47 of the duration of terms, and I would suggest that term be defined because if, for instance, someone resigns a day before the expiry of the term, it does not conclude a full term, which means that person can then immediately be considered for a next term. So therefore, term should be defined, I would suggest. And then lastly, in section 48, there's reference to the word referral. Referral of what by whom? What does that referral then actually mean in the subsections A, B, A and B? What referral? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Member. Let's get Honorable Lawrence McDonald whilst we asking Honorable Mangu to stick to the principle of the lowering of the hand.
It came up again, Chair. It was lowered with your...
Okay. What?
One small point, if you may indulge me. Thank you.
I will indulge you after Honorable McDonald. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson Mangete. My only question, or if I can get some clarity, it says there in 47.5, each member of the council serves on a full-time or part-time basis. Chairperson, would it not be better that council members serve on a full-time basis, because the council is going to have a lot of work and it's going to affect the council's work if, for an argument's sake, many of the members are part-time, and then that's going to make it difficult for them to have meetings because some of the members will not be available to attend the meeting. So my humble submission, Chairperson, is that council members should be full-time members. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable McDee. Let's get Uchambas back.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Appreciate your indulgence.
Yes.
Section 48, that's where I missed it. It was in my points, under council functions and procedures, in particular subsection 3, subsection A. I will read it quickly. Where it starts, says the chairperson of the council must manage the caseload blah, 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 and must, subsection A, that is where I'm drawing our attention, ensure that at least one member of the panel is a person who has legal training and experience. Now, my understanding, Chair, is that a person who will be in the panel would have been a member of the council. Nowhere does it say it could be somebody from outside. If therefore my understanding is correct, the chairperson doesn't have a say of who or what qualifications of people must be in the panel. How then does the chairperson ensure that one of the members is a person with legal training in that process, because it's already very late? And I did not pick up, unless in the appointment of the council, there must be at least one legal person in that council. That is my comment, chairperson, in that particular section. Thank you once more. Thank you, Advocate. I think that answers me.
Honorable Manu, can you then lower your hand? Thank you very much. We'll keep on reminding each other as we move. Thank you. let's get Advocate Nell, do you want to say something before I give the department?
Chair, I think on the point raised by the member now, specifically regarding the legal qualification or requirement, that is why when I went through the section, I drew members' attention to the use here of and. Whereas in the board appointment, the use is or. Because it's quite often not possible to get somebody that has all of these qualifications in one or experience in one person, which is normally why they use or in the appointments. But we do see some legislation that has specifications that the makeup of the board or a council must have at least one member with, then it would be qualifications and or experience in. And then they will list either law, economics, accounting, or transport industry, or transport economics, however those requirements are. So, Chi, if the committee wishes to be phrased in such a way that they can say at least one member with, then I'm sure our legal drafters can just give their input on that. And then I think the legal drafters can also just give their input on the concern raised about use of and here in terms of the qualifications required for this appointment. Chair, that's the only input I would like to make here before we hear from the department and the legal advisors.
Okay, let's hear the legal advisors. Ms. Tolosin.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to work backwards, if I may. So the very last comment about the legal qualification, 4713, as Advocate Nell has pointed out, does specify that the persons with experience in law, economics, accounting, and the transportation industry, perhaps you'd want to look at that and an or. As Advocate Nell mentioned earlier, it is difficult to have somebody with all those qualifications. So we can look at that. And then with regards to the question raised about full-time members, I think that's an important point, especially given the caseload of the council. With regards to the comments about whether the PFMA is applicable, section 46.1. Seeing as it's an institution outside the public service, but it's an organ of state within the public administration, I'm of the view that the PMFA is applicable, but I would like to just go and double check and come back on that particular point. And those are the points that I've just made to respond to, Chair. Is there, I may have, if I can just be guided, I'm not sure if I've missed one or two comments, Chair, but those are the comments that I've responded to.
Okay. Ms. Harry-Cherin?
Chair, I concur with my colleague, the Parliamentary Legal Advisor. Just with regards to the one concern raised by the member, Honorable Mr. Manko, regarding the definition of the word related as it is used in the bill. Chair, in terms of the bill, the word related, if I may refer to the definition section, the clause one, if I may read the definition, says the term related, when used in respect of two persons, has the meaning set out in section one of the Companies Act 2008, Act number 71 of 2008. And if I may then refer to the Companies Act 2008 and the manner in which the word related is defined in section one of the Companies Act. Chair, I'm reading directly from the Act in front of me. Yes. The term related as defined in Section 1 of the Companies Act 2008 reads, related when used in respect of two persons means persons who are connected to one another in any manner contemplated in Section 2, Subsection 1, Subsection A to C. And further to that, Section 2 of the Companies Act 2008 makes provision for related and interrelated persons and controls. And the detailed provisions are provided therein regarding a related person in terms of the Companies Act. And this would apply to the Economic Regulation Transfer Bill as well. So this should give greater clarity in regard to the use of the word related person. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Harry-Cherin. The department, do you have anything to say?
Thank you, Chair. I've got one or two points to make to help the committee. With the regard to PFMA issue, I may add one or two views there. The idea when the bill was drafted was that when it begins to operate, it will rely on the resources from government, because the secretariat would have been employed to assist with administrative functions of the council. And secondly, part of its finances would come from government. With those two provisos, I would think the PFMA would apply, but obviously the legal people will try and look at this matter and confirm, Chair. And there was an issue around referrals, Chair. And when you read those points on referrals, they make reference to, I think, Section 16 and Section 19, if I remember quite well, because I can't go through my document. And the understanding from my side is that the council could refer the matter that is at hand at that given point in time to either the regulator or to the complainant or the appellant, Chair. But I think for the purpose of the committee, maybe let's read the
Section 48(1)(a)(b) together with Section 16 and 19. Maybe that would give the answer, the answer to the question that was raised to what is meant by a referral. The other point that was made by double. Donald was around part-time with his arguments. The argument is genuine. However, the way it is coached, this clause related to part-time or full-time, it's to cater for the workload that would be at the hands of at the office of the council at an initial stage, because the anticipation is that when this new regulator becomes in place, at the initial stage, they would not have a lot of cases or a lot of cases. And therefore, when you have full-time members, you would have full-time members who would be paid and resources, which is not commensurate to the work that would have been at given moments. But as and when the council basically operates and has experience and receives a lot of cases, then that's where the clause comes in. Is there a need for a full-time council to be in place or not? And then if yes, then the law puts in a way the full-time members are appointed, well, part-time members are then appointed on a full-time council. There's an issue around the weight relation or related. It's just that to the screen shared, so I can't respond to that one, but I will attempt to respond to that one as we proceed, because I'll get an opportunity to look at it on my phone, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Advocate. Okay, before you, I can see the hand of Honorable McDonald.
Chairperson, yes, thank you. Regarding the temporary permanent board members or council members, Chairperson, it was previously stated by the department that as far as they are envisioning in the future that there will be no job losses when all of these regulators are amalgamated into this one thing. But, Chairperson, if a person is going to be removed from one entity, then move to this entity and now is going from full-time to part-time, it's going to affect that person financially and it's going to affect that person in his work conditions, Chairperson. So, I'm still not 100% convinced in that wording, Chairperson, but yeah, that's just my submission. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, honorable member. Honorable Manu.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe my question is going back to the related as explained by the colleague there. So I'm assuming therefore that the council is established in terms of the Companies Act, because reference is therefore made to the Companies Act, or because it relates to the directors or the disqualification of directors, which are according to the Companies Act. So, but I'm more interested in the council itself. The directors one, I do understand. So is the council therefore established in terms of the Companies Act? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Can we get some clarity on that before we move on? The two members will lower their hands. I know they still remember. Advocate, you want to say something?
I think the legal advisors in going back and just having a look at some of those appointment issues, they can just clarify on the question that was raised by the member now on application of the Companies Act to the council. We might get some reference to when we get to the financing section on the remuneration of the board, as well as the council members possibly being linked to the regulations and directives given by National Treasury. That is also something that, again, also links back to other legislation. One could also argue that both the council and the board, in terms of a clause that reads in this manner, that it would be subject to the constitution and the law. So one can argue broadly that the Companies Act might be applicable in that sense as well. But Chair, if we can give the legal advisors just some opportunity at the next engagement to get back on that manner, that matter. I think also just for throwing some extra information in terms of the argument for and against full-time or part-time basis, in terms of the employment, a full-time appointment is not necessarily a permanent appointment. That's also something that needs to be looked at when we do get information on the HR and the movement of employees from one current regulated entity to this one, because that would need some information on how those employees are currently employed. Are they permanent? Are they on fixed-term contracts? Then along with that, your permanent appointments as well as your fixed-term contracts, even in terms of the Public Service Act, can also be on a basis of either full-time or part-time. The argument that the department does bring in that in the beginning you might only need part-time employees is definitely a valid agreement, because chances are that there will be very few cases as the council starts to teeth. But that could possibly be assisted if the department can bring members some information on what the caseload or the consideration of reviews and appeals at the ports regulator is at the moment, given that they will be starting out with them in phase one, just to give some clarity. But it might be a good idea to just get some input on that, because the way that they did phrase this in the bill or proposed this phrasing does allow for full-time contracts, even though not permanent. It could be fixed-term full-time. I know that's also a mouthful, Chair. And then I can just get your guidance whether or not we are then ready to move on to finances, or whether there's still some clarity needed on those aspects.
Advocate, thank you very much. I think at this point, because we are moving on to finances, that's what you are saying. Am I right?
Okay, Chair.
Saying, is that what you are proposing to hear from me?
I would suggest that, Chair, especially because here we do see the reference to the Public Finance Management Act under the finances, so this might also assist members in that question of this, Chair.
Okay. Let me just talk to members so that they don't see me as a chairperson who's... I know that we was it is written 9 to 12, and it is 1 minute past 12 now. But I will request members that we should push up until 1, so that we allow the department to go and prepare whatever we shall be looking for from the department on the 10th. Am I getting a nod from the members, Honorable Hansinger?
Chairperson, can I ask that you will please excuse me? I planned another meeting to start in 10 minutes time, based on the schedule, so can you please excuse me?
Okay, Honorable Member.
Thank you.
I think let's do this so that we are fair to other members. I think Honorable Pete May also had requested that by 12, he'll want to leave because of the time schedule we had set ourselves. Would I be fair that maybe let's deal with the finances on the 10th of February, that is Wednesday next week, advocate, and allow me then to, according to our schedule, close this meeting so that we don't leave other members behind. I think it's important that we move as a unit in this piece of legislation. So with that, honorable members, allow me to thank you for the thorough preparation and the department. I think we're beginning to move on this piece of legislation. There will be a lot of issues that we'll need to thresh. We must just be patient with each other. And with that, allow me then to bring this meeting to its logical conclusion. I want to thank you for your participation, all the participants who were with us today, officials of the department, officials of portfolio committee, and honorable members. This meeting is adjourned until the 10th of February. Thank you very much.
As the chairperson, please.
My hand was up, Chairperson Mangete, but I'll submit, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable McDonald. Sorry about that. Long live.
As the chair pleases,
long live the chair.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Please go to your different activities in Parliament. Thank you. You are released.